Hey everyone, this is Nick Deolius. Good to be with you. This is podcast number 15 of The Far Middle. And this is, I guess, our end of summer podcast because we're coming up on Labor Day in a couple of days from now. Hard to believe that summer 2021's already flew by us, but yet here we are. And I just mentioned this is the 15th installment of The Far Middle, but in many ways, it's the first of a new chapter, a new generation of Far Middle podcast, because this is the first one that we're going to be able to discuss areas and issues far afield from the subject of my upcoming book, The Leech. So we've been using the prior podcast, the first 14, to go chapter by chapter through the book and highlight and dive deeper on some of the topics and subtopics that the book discusses and raises. And if you've been listening through those podcasts, if you've been the constant listener, I want to thank you for investing the time over that journey over the past 14 weeks. I hope you found it fulfilling. I hope you got a rate of return out of it. I certainly have by participating in it. And again, I want to thank you if you were able to do so as well. But podcast number 15 and these future ones now, we've got the freedom and the flexibility to talk about and discuss whatever topics we may so choose. And we plan on using that flexibility and that optionality to really go into avenues that are either current or relevant or hopefully a combination of both that are things that you're reading about today that might be on your mind and that, again, are certainly on mine as well. With the new era of the Far Middle podcast, maybe it's important to point out at the beginning of this episode number 15 some of the things that haven't changed. One thing that hasn't changed is my website, nickdeolius.com. I'd still encourage you to give that a look from time to time, periodically. I will be posting new content, new essays, and thought pieces. We'll discuss a lot of those on upcoming podcast episodes. But now that we got through the publication of the book, The Leech, I've got the time and the availability to start posting content, which I really enjoy, and I hope you enjoy it as well. So click on nickdeolius.com from time to time. Just give it a read under the commentary section. See what's new out there. It's also where you can access the Far Middle podcast as well. Another thing that hasn't changed is the hard copy and ebook version of The Leech will be out in January of next year. So if you go to the website, nickdeolius.com, you can see the links to Amazon and to Barnes & Noble, IndieBound for independent bookstores if you prefer those that'll carry it. And you also obviously can go directly to those websites if you so choose, but you can pre-order or order a copy up ready for January of next year, which will be here before we know it, believe it or not. And then Twitter, of course, at Nick Deolius, posting basically a tweet a day, sometimes two tweets a day, depending on what's going on in the world, but tying that into a lot of the different themes and subjects we've discussed on prior as well as future podcasts of The Far Middle. So a lot hasn't changed. And I hope that also includes your commitment of time that you've invested to listen along week by week. Definitely appreciate that. Now, another question I got quite a bit over the past 14 weeks about the podcast was along the lines of what my preparation was. Do I script these out? How much thought do I put or invest into the podcast prior to recording them? And generally, the answer has been I don't script these. I might have an outline that I'll handwrite going into a podcast that you prepare for or something like that. But beyond that, sort of very rudimentary approach, nothing scripted. I think it's better just sometimes to speak from the gut and from the heart. It comes out better that way, both in terms of content and better sounding. But when you are looking at the podcast mapping the subjects and the chapters in the book, The Leech, the preparation in many ways was already done ahead of time because the writing of the book basically prepared you for the podcast for that chapter or that item. With these new episodes, and particularly for this one, episode number 15, I'm going to take a bit of a different approach. And I'd ask for your patience and support through this. I'm going to try something that's a little more organic. So I've got some general ideas in my head that I've sort of worked through over the past couple of days that I think will be good topics to bring up for this podcast. And they may at times seem a bit chaotic or helter-skelter. They may not seem to be related at different points, but I think by the time this podcast concludes, you'll see that these individual items and individual points, you can connect those dots into a coherent message theme for the podcast. So I'm looking forward to see how this goes, and I hope you enjoy it. And the topics we're going to cover in this podcast and future podcasts, they're going to be very wide ranging. They're going to basically mirror what I've been posting over the past year or so on the website, nickdeolius.com. So certainly we're going to be talking about energy. That's front and center and near and dear to my heart. Business will play a prominent role with the topic of all things business related. Politics and policy, right? I've got a passion for that. I know that many of us out there have massive amounts of interest in those issues in 2021. I'm going to talk about sports. This podcast will be a good example of that. Music, literature, love discussing literature and different books and how their meaning plays even larger today than when they were originally written. We'll talk some philosophy. Technology, I think, will be a topic that we visit time and time again, and culture. So very wide-ranging. I'm going to try to connect those dots, as I said, episode by episode. But I think the broader scope will really allow us to bear into some really interesting themes and concepts and maybe some different takes and viewpoints on them as well. And the topic I want to start with is something that I had no intention of discussing 3 days ago. But over the past couple of days, I've been listening to, when I drive in the car to and from, I'll put on sports talk radio. There's two stations in Pittsburgh or time slots that carry it. And I'll listen in periodically, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, depending on how long the drive is, here and there at different times during the day. And it just sort of dawned on me a couple of days prior that all of these sports talk shows and all of these sports talk stations, at least in the Pittsburgh area, and I'm sure that it's true for other major cities as well across the country, all they're talking about is NFL preseason. The preseason exhibition games and this issue and that issue. Of course, the focus here is on the Pittsburgh Steelers, relentlessly, but you know, pick your city, that'll define the team that the obsession falls upon, and then talking about preseason football. Not the, just to quote maybe Allen Iverson, not the regular season, not the real game, but practice, right? The preseason. And I can't stand NFL preseason. So I just look at that, and I've never gotten into it. Don't understand it, why it takes so long, why there's so much attention paid to it. I mean, first and foremost, I think the biggest, most fundamental issue I've got with preseason is that the games are completely meaningless. They mean nothing. They mean nothing from a record perspective. They mean nothing contractually with the established players. They're just something that are events and investments of time that you go through, and when the game is over, nobody remembers what happened 2 weeks down the road, and definitely no one's going to remember what happened a month later or let alone a year later. I can't even tell you what the preseason games were last year that the Steelers or any other team engaged in, or who did what, or who had good games or bad games, et cetera. So, you know, from a fan perspective, the relevance of the game itself, because it is exhibition, is at zero. In some instances, I might argue it's negative relevance. It's actually taking relevance away from some other things that we should be paying attention to at the time with its opportunity cost of time that it demands. Another big issue that sort of leads to my disdain for NFL preseason football is that you have these games occurring during the summertime. And I just can't get in my head equating summertime with football. To me, football is fall, winter, and if it's hot and sunny and you're sweating, let alone the players are sweating, that's not where football should be played. That's baseball season. That is not football season. I had another commute yesterday, just driving from point A to point B, and one of the very well-known sports broadcasters on one of these sports talk shows is talking about the upcoming game. This is going to be the third Steelers preseason game tomorrow, and it's going to be in Pittsburgh at Heinz Field, and he was talking about what a great day it's going to be for football, 85 degrees and sunny. Well, as soon as I hear 85 and sunny and then football, that to me, that cannot be a great day for football. A great day for football would be snow or maybe some rain, maybe some mixed rain, snow, and sleet, a chill in the air, if not freezing cold. And I just can't can't get into to summertime weather, summertime feel in football and pads and helmets. They just don't go together. Then you've got some contemporary issues that that are playing a role with my dislike for preseason football, and COVID and pandemic is front and center. Because when you saw the onset of COVID, I don't think that it was coincidence that it, one of the casualties was maybe the one thing that I did like about preseason NFL football, which was training camp. You know, seeing people, mostly with younger families, little kids, going out to the different training camps at NFL teams, the locations that they hold it at. For the Steelers for decades, it was with St. Vincent's College in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh. But you'd see them lugging lawn chairs and coolers and basically having a picnic on some hillside with the kids, you know, watching the Steelers or whichever NFL team of choice practice. And it was almost a rite of passage for families and children and kids, and the kids would get into it. And it was just something to pass the time, a little a family event. And it was always awesome to see that. That was the one thing that I really liked about preseason, exhibition, training camp sort of football. COVID comes along. What happens? First thing that happens is we do away with that. So no more training camp in Latrobe at St. Vincent's, lugging the kids out in the coolers and the lawn chairs and watching the Steelers practice while you get a suntan or a sunburn. Instead, you know, it's a much more controlled environment. Certain days the public can go view, and then during those days it's all controlled with respect to who goes and how many goes. And it's almost like more of a game experience, which changes the whole dynamic and I think the whole point of the fan interaction that you had with training camp originally. And I suspect, and it's just a suspicion, I can't prove it, but I suspect most NFL teams and their ownership and the players like it this way. They don't want the fan interaction that you had with training camp. Professional athletes don't want to go live in dorms of college campuses in the summer with a roommate. The coaching staff and the ownership probably don't care for it either, because it's probably a big logistical headache with very little return of investment, at least in terms of dollars. So I suspect that one of the biggest reasons why you had the casualty recently of training camp and that training camp experience with the fans at the location of choice wasn't just because of pandemic. The pandemic created an opportunity for in a window, right, an opening for ownership, the teams and the players to alter and do away with something that sort of bugged them or was a headache from the get-go in terms of how they perceived it. But my issues with preseason football don't end there. Another issue I've got, it seems every year the big topic or one of the biggest topics of conversation during preseason football is everybody's talking about this player who's holding out or that player who wants a contract extension, salary cap issues, you know, more of the business and the dollars and cents of the game, which really, from a fan perspective, has nothing to do with what's going on the field, but, you know, impacts what's going on in the field to a very large extent when it affects who's playing for which team and for what stakes. But this year with the Steelers, just to use them as the example, the big issue is TJ Watt. And is he going, he wants an extension and he wants guaranteed money, some pretty enormous numbers when it comes to the guaranteed money and contract headline number that he's looking for. They're talking in the neighborhood of $100 million or northwards of that for an edge rusher. But that's been the discussion constantly on sports talk radio and just radio in general and TV when it comes to sports. TJ Watt, his contract, Steelers negotiating ploy. Do you get something done now? Do you get something done later contractually? He's not practicing now with full pads and contact drills, but he's showing up and working out. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? How long does he need to not engage in full contact practice before it becomes a problem? What happens as you approach the first game of the regular season? All this drama about one player and a contractual issue. And again, it's an ask for a contract extension and what these two entities, the team and the player, are going to do. Doesn't make for, you know, compelling talk, radio, TV, and fan interest. It doesn't get me interested. And, you know, that coupled with just the nature of what's going on with the preseason games themselves. What I mean by the nature of it, it seems like the nature of these preseason games more and more is to never play your starters, you know, the legitimate or best players that are going to start the regular season games, never play them for extended periods of time during these games. The big debate now coming up for this third exhibition game is Ben Roethlisberger going to take a few snaps or a few series as quarterback or not during the game against Detroit? And once again, besides TJ Watt and his contract, it's all this debate and discussion whether he should just sit the entire preseason, all the games for all that, save himself for the regular season, or no, do you need to, you know, get the rust off and polish your skills up and get a few series in under center to get things moving and get that dynamic going. Very nonsensical, I think, over the long haul. It's certainly not something that fans are particularly going to be engaged with, where they're going to be compelled to listen, watch, and tune in. And you get these cliches, right? Every sportscaster out there or somebody who, you know, blogger who thinks they know something or deems themselves an expert in football, the surprise of camp so far. There's always a surprise of camp. And I always wanted to do an exercise where you go back through time, go back year after year in the past, team by team, and just sort of record who everybody or everyone thinks the surprise of camp was at that point in time, and then see, did that correlate to success either that year, that season, in the regular season, or for that player over the course of his career? I'm not so sure that it does correlate. I don't think the surprise of camp, the person that stands out that no one knew of prior to training camp on an NFL team, I'm not so sure they end up with Hall of Fame careers giving speeches in Canton down the road in a number of years. But it would be an interesting exercise to do that, or if someone's already done that, that would be a pretty cool thing to see the results with respect to. And coaches, general managers, the front staff, the leadership of the teams, they go out of their way to talk and talk and talk at news conferences and before practices and after practices, before games and after games. But if you read the transcripts of what they're saying, they do a tremendous job, a very effective job of talking a lot and saying absolutely nothing. There is nothing there of substance. And I guess you just get really good at doing that if you're a head coach in the NFL or a general manager in the NFL, where, again, your lips are moving, you're talking, you're being recorded, you're following up, answering questions. But I'll be damned if you see anything of substance that these individuals are answering. And I don't think that's by accident. And then last but not least, the thing that really sort of just gets me going when it comes to exhibition football and preseason. Upcoming game, right? Again, tomorrow's another game with Detroit. What to look for? What are the keys to this game? What to look for in this game? And because it's exhibition and because it means nothing, what sportscasters and bloggers and people that obsess about this stuff, what they'll reach for is some strange things. And for this game with the Steelers, everybody's latched on to this concept that we've got a new offensive line that's basically been patched together since last year. A lot of retirements and people leaving through free agency and not renewing contracts have occurred with the Steelers on the offensive line. So now you've got this new offensive line that's going to come into existence for the upcoming season, and all kinds of questions individually, position by position on the offensive line, and then the unit as a total. So this is going to be the first time that it's anticipated the sort of anticipated starting lineup for the offensive line will actually take the field together during this upcoming exhibition game, at least again for a series or a couple of series. That's the must-see item with respect to this exhibition game. You're going to see the offensive line that we think is going to be the lineup that starts on the first game of the regular season. They might actually be on the field together side by side for the first time during this third exhibition game. Not enough to get me to watch for sure. And for those of you out there that are season ticket holders of a professional football team, right, in the NFL, you know that the exhibition games, the preseason games, you got to buy those if you're going to be a season ticket holder. They're not optional. And you got to pay full price. They're the same price as regular season game tickets, which is ridiculous. I can remember when I was in my 20s that if you didn't have regular season season tickets, right, which we didn't, you know, most 20-some-year-olds don't, there would inevitably during preseason be these calls going out of the season ticket holders that were looking to unload their preseason tickets. A, they didn't want to go because they're meaningless games, and B, you know, they were looking for a way to try to cover the cost that they had to put out to buy these because the teams force them to. And that's why you see stands that are basically empty during preseason games and a lot of unhappy season ticket holders, because it's almost a hidden cost of a regular season ticket. Because there's a couple of exhibition games, like I said, full price for the ticket. You got to buy them if you're a season ticket holder, but you're not going to go because, again, the games are meaningless. So, you know, what's there to look for in the upcoming game, whether it's the Steelers or another NFL team this week of exhibition football? Well, the answer is not to look for the first rendition of the offensive line on the field that's going to start game one of the regular season. The answer is there's nothing to look for in the upcoming game. It's a meaningless event, and it should be treated as such. Now, I get why there is interest in preseason football, because, hey, football's awesome. And anything that's awesome that you look forward to, the hint of it coming back, is something to be excited about. And sort of exhibition season, training camp, preseason football is that. It's a proxy. It's a harbinger for something coming up that I really like, which is regular season NFL football, and same with college football. So I get why there's just a general interest. It makes you feel good. But the flip side of this is there's nothing else going on in the sports world right now, particularly in Pittsburgh. So you've got baseball, MLB in full swing, but the Pirates are horrible. It's horrible with a capital H. I mean, they're going to set records perhaps for some modern day poor performance on the field by the time the season's over, especially if they keep going at the recent clip they've been on, which is just an abysmal clip. Right now they're 42-79. Believe it or not, 42 wins, 79 losses. If they keep this pace, they're going to lose over 100 games for the season. Their winning percentage is .347. There's players with batting averages that are higher than the Pirates' winning percentage. And the last 10 games, I think they're 1-9. Who knows? They might end up being 0-10 here. They're 32 games back out of first place. So you're not going to be very entertained watching the Pirates right now. That's the only professional league that's in full swing. The hockey and NHL and Stanley Cup is long gone. All the hockey players are playing golf right now. NBA is done. So there's really nothing else, especially if you're in a city like Pittsburgh where the baseball team is not looking very good at all. So I get why at least there's a general interest in preseason football, but it shouldn't go past the generality and the just a superficial level of interest. Which got me to thinking, when I started to think about, you know, the Pirates, and just I've been watching them and tracking them, actually, maybe ironic in a way, but watching them because they've been so bad. I guess there's a lot of interest, obviously, when teams and your team's doing really well, you get caught up in it. But there's also, I find myself tracking some of my teams quite a bit when they're doing really poorly, because that in some grotesque way becomes something of interest as well. So I've been following them, and I got onto this thought for the podcast. I said, you know, with the Pirates being just such a historic team, a historic brand, going back over 100 plus years of legacy, people don't realize, people view Pittsburgh as a football town with the Steelers in the 70s and then a hockey town with Mario Lemieux and Sidney Crosby and all the success that they've had with multiple Stanley Cups starting in the early 90s. And that's true on both counts. But originally, people not from Pittsburgh don't understand us. And the current generation often doesn't understand us either, because it's been so long. But Pittsburgh, historically, first and foremost, was a baseball town. The Pirates held sway over this town and its fan base and its attention for just decades and decades and multiple generations. It wasn't only until the last 20 plus years of ineptitude that has changed, coupled with, right, the success of these other teams in the other sports and predominantly Steelers and Penguins. But if you start thinking about the Pirates and all that history, the 100 plus years of history, you start to think about the Mount Rushmore question, which is, you know, four presidents up on Mount Rushmore. Who would be the Mount Rushmore, the four greatest Pirates of all time? I think that's a really interesting question, not just for the Pirates, but for a lot of different things, right? But for the Pirates, just because of their expansive history, and just thinking through that, and who would you put on that Mount Rushmore for the Pittsburgh baseball Pirates? I thought, boy, wouldn't this be a cool item to discuss for the Far Middle podcast? And when I started to think this through, boy, I was, A, having a lot more fun thinking about this than I was about NFL preseason football with the Steelers, for sure. But B, I immediately came to three names that I knew for sure needed to be up there. But boy, when I got to the pick in the fourth, it got really interesting. But first with the three names, two of them are no-brainers. Roberto Clemente absolutely has to be on that that facade of the mountain when it comes to the Mount Rushmore for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Just an unbelievable career, unbelievable human being, massive impact outside of baseball with everything that that he had accomplished and done. What a better place the world is because of Roberto Clemente. And two, of course, Hannes Wagner, going way back and defining sort of just the baseball player at the time and the position that he played and just the records that he set and how he performed and his sort of friendship slash rivalry with Ty Cobb back in the day in that one famous World Series. Hannes Wagner, one of the first inductees, right, for the inaugural induction class to the Baseball Hall of Fame. He's just legendary. So you got to have Hannes Wagner up there. You got to have Roberto Clemente. The third name is someone that, based on what he accomplished on the field and his abilities, definitely, I think, deserves to be up there. Just not a player that I particularly cared for, especially toward the end of his career, and didn't play his entire career, unlike Clemente and Wagner with the Pirates, and that is Barry Bonds. I know there's the issue, of course, with steroids. There's just the issue with how Barry Bonds just approached people and dealt with fans and media and teammates, et cetera. But when you just look at his skill set, and you can go back before he really started to launch home runs and when potentially some issues with performance enhancement drugs started or allegedly, right? He just was just an unbelievable player. And he was a Hall of Fame player from day one, at least from my perspective. I was a kid when turned into a young man when he first popped up on the scene. But you could tell, you just knew that Barry Bonds was just a talent that superseded everyone else on the field and everyone else on every other team. So I got to put Bonds up there just because I need to be objective. I want to be clinical about this. And I just think that when you look at the skill sets, he did it all. He had it all. And I think the course of his career speaks to that. So that's three. But then Mount Rushmore has four faces up there. Who's the fourth? And that leads to some really interesting discussion and debate. Now I'm going to tell you at the end. So what I did first was I just thought through this and came up with a list. And this is my one piece of preparation for this podcast. I've got this hand scrawled list and in my poor handwriting that's a list of players that I just wrote down as ones that either, you know, from a performance perspective and impact perspective, et cetera, just deserve consideration to be that fourth Pirate on the Pittsburgh Pirates Mount Rushmore. But then I also attached each name sort of a label as they would be up there because they were the best blank. And I'll talk about what that best would be for each player. And then at the end of this, of course, I'll give you my choice for who I would put up there as the fourth face. So the first name that I came up with was Dave Parker, the Cobra. And Dave Parker was during, you know, in his heyday when I was a kid growing up in Pittsburgh. And my dad, my grandfather, my uncles, they all were ushers at Three Rivers Stadium. That was a second job for them on the side. So inevitably, you know, the life of an usher back then for baseball season was you had to show up about 2 hours before game time. And then you were allowed to leave during the seventh inning or around the seventh inning. So inevitably, myself and my cousins and my brother, we would be dragged down to Three Rivers, and we didn't have to be dragged down. We loved the opportunity to go with our dads and our uncles and grandfather. And I became an expert on batting practice because I saw every player in the National League over the course of probably a 10-year span take batting practice dozens and dozens and dozens of times because you had to be there 2 hours before first pitch. And I never saw in person the end of a baseball game. I never saw the eighth and ninth innings because on the seventh inning, we were in a car heading back home to get home after a long day at the stadium. But I remember Dave Parker during his heyday when he was with the Pirates. And I just remember this like it was yesterday. we're in the stands and I'm with my dad and we're just sitting there watching the players take batting practice. And this was later in the baseball season. So it was right around this time of year. It was very late August, early September. So at the time, Three River Stadium was used for both baseball and football. It would be converted from one field to another, like most of those multi-use stadiums would do in the 70s. And since this was late in the baseball season, it was early in exhibition football season. And I remember the field being sort of, you know, a bit tore up and realigned for a baseball diamond. And there were two individuals down on the field talking to one another. And one was a, you know, big guy, but the other one was just an enormous individual, just tall and just built and just a very powerful looking individual. So my dad says, look at that down there. You see Joe Green down there. This is Mean Joe Green from the Pittsburgh Steelers, which, you know, probably the most iconic Steeler. We'll do the Mount Rushmore of the Steelers maybe one day, but he certainly would be up there. And I look at the two of them and I said, oh, that's the tall guy. And my dad says, no, Joe Green's the smaller guy. The tall guy's Dave Parker. Dave Parker made Joe Green, Mean Joe Green, almost look like a kid when they stood side by side just talking to each other, which was pretty cool in and of itself, right? Mean Joe Green talking to Dave Parker. You don't see that too often in a sports town. But the Cobra, yeah, I think he would be a consideration for that fourth only because what's he the best? He's probably the best talent or the best raw talent. I remember that one World Series game that he had with throwing some runners out from right field and just his skill set again and his size and the size combined with the skill, probably best raw talent. So he gets consideration for number four as best raw talent. Another name, way before Dave Parker, Ralph Kiner. Ralph Kiner was a really, really good player, Hall of Fame player on a really, really bad set of Pirates teams through the time that he played in Pittsburgh. So I put Ralph Kiner up there for consideration. He's a Hall of Famer, awesome player. But I put him up there as the best what? Best player that people would pay to see. I saw some statistics where they showed what the attendance was, the paid attendance for the Pirates during seasons when Ralph Kiner was there and the record was horrible. And then what happened to attendance the year after he left the team. And it plummeted. I want to say almost dropped to half of what it was. People literally back in the day, you didn't buy a ticket to go watch the Pirates play because they were pathetic. They were horrible. You bought a ticket to watch Ralph Kiner play. And when Ralph Kiner had his last at bat toward the end of the game, literally the stadium would empty because there was nothing left to see after that. The Pirates were going to lose the game. He wasn't going to come up to bat again. What was the point? Get an early start, getting home and beating traffic. So he would be the best that you would pay player to pay to see. How about Paul and Lloyd Wehner? So this is Big Poison and Little Poison. That's the best combination, brother combination. Two brothers, both played for the Pirates. Paul, Hall of Famer, he was Big Poison. And what's funny, I never knew this, but I don't know if some of you know this or not, but his nickname with being Big Poison and Lloyd was Little Poison. Paul Wehner, Big Poison, he was 5'8". So not exactly a giant, but in the late 1920s, you know, maybe not all that smallish, but, you know, 5'8", it's not somebody you'd think would have the nickname of Big Poison, but compared to his brother, he was big. But the Wehners were awesome. By the way, the Wehner brothers have the most hits in Major League Baseball history by brothers. So they've got a record of their own that they're proud of. Andrew McCutchen. Here's another, you know, great player. I really enjoyed watching him, continue to enjoy watching him. He's one of those players, no matter where he goes, I'm always rooting for him. I think he should be considered for that Mount Rushmore as best person. He just seemed to be an awesome individual, almost like Clemente, but just a great guy. And he's the type of person, as I said, you root for, whether he's playing for the Phillies or wherever he's at. I hope Andrew McCutchen always does well. I'm always pulling for him. Pie Trainer. Best lifer. He just was a lifelong Pirate from, you know, player, coach, clubhouse guy. He just stayed on with the Pirates for years and years and years. And by the way, a lot of people don't know this about Pie Trainer. He was the first third baseman that was elected into the Baseball Hall of Fame. So he had a great career. How about a guy by the name, many of you may not know this name, Fred Clark. Now, Fred Clark would be considered as the best player manager because he was a player. This is back in the Hannes Wagner era, way back when. And he also was a longtime manager and a great manager for the Pirates. In fact, I think this is still the case. You got to watch it with the changing statistics over time. But I believe Fred Clark is top 10 in Pirates franchise wins as manager. And he's also top 10 for Pirates in terms of career hits. So you can see that player-manager dual threat that he brought to the table, top 10 in wins for the organization as well as top 10 in hits. That's a pretty cool combination of statistics. But speaking of managers, how about the best manager? Best manager, I think, is Danny Murtaugh. Danny Murtaugh won two World Series with the Pirates, of course, 1960 against the Yankees and 71 against the Orioles. Really, I think, did a nice job with a lot of the players and just was like one of those personalities in baseball, like Tommy Lasorda, Casey Stengel. I think Danny Murtaugh was one of those types of individuals. Died much too young, but I'd put him up there for consideration as best manager. How about the best player you never heard of? The best unknown player? I think that would be Archie Vaughn. Probably one of the best shortstops in Major League Baseball history. Certainly the best shortstop for the Pirates who wasn't named Hannes. So outside of Hannes Wagner, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of people, even Pirates fans, don't know the name Archie Vaughn that well. It's just because Hannes Wagner preceded him and just defined that position of shortstop. But Archie Vaughn was a Hall of Fame player and shortstop in his own right. So I guess the best, greatest player that you don't know. And then Bill Mazeroski. How can we forget Bill Mazeroski? Because he gets consideration for that fourth face just as the best moment. And the moment, of course, was the 1960 World Series, Game 7, walk-off home run. By the way, Mazeroski just was an unbelievable defensive player. He took place in more double plays than anyone else in Major League Baseball history. So he's just an unbelievable fielder. And just a rock when it came to turning the double play there as a Pirate. Now, I run through a bunch of great names. And again, you can make the case for these individual names, case-by-case basis, for being the fourth name on that Mount Rushmore. But I'm going to go with someone else. Of course, who I'm going to go with is my personal Pirate favorite of all time, which is Willie Stargell. Best captain, right? Best leader. Billy Stargell and what he did in the 60s and then obviously the 70s and then early 80s through his career. Just an awesome career. Great guy. Beloved in Pittsburgh. Beloved by his teammates. So I'd put Willie Stargell up there just as a Hall of Famer that could hit the ball a mile. Great leader in the clubhouse and got a couple World Series under his belt as well with 71 and 79. So Willie Stargell's my fourth, but like I said, you can see just going through those names, the history and how deep the legacy is of the Pittsburgh Pirates organization. That's why it's so tough and sad to see the current state that they're in right now. And speaking of those World Series, I mentioned the 1960 and the 71 and the 1979 World Series wins and titles by the Pirates. What's really cool about those three is all three of them went to seven games, so that makes it an exciting series in and of themselves. But they were just really interesting dynamics and drama that unfolded for each in their own ways. The 1960 World Series, Pirates went up against just the historic Yankees team, right? Just a murderer's row of sluggers and Hall of Famers and big-name pitchers and just outsized personalities. But as I said, Bill Mazeroski hitting that home run, that walk-off, in Game 7 of the World Series was just probably the defining number one moment of all World Series moments when you look at the history of the World Series. And if not number one, certainly top three. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed. The only reason it wouldn't be considered number one, perhaps, because it was back in 1960, and most people assessing it currently weren't alive to see it when it happened. Against the Yankees, right, that made it special because, again, during that time, the Yankees were just stacked. They were just sort of the Darth Vader in the empire of Major League Baseball at the time. Mickey Mantle, during the 60 series, he had a monster series, had a really good World Series. But when he lost and the Yankees lost to the Pirates, he cried. I mean, basically Bill Mazeroski. And that's, I think, a famous line from the movie of A Bronx Tale, which is an awesome movie. We'll be talking about movies in upcoming podcasts, but if you like movies, check out The Bronx Tale. And if you've seen the movie, you know there was a sequence in there where the kid at the time was talking to the gangster about how he hated Bill Mazeroski because he made Mickey Mantle cry. That's coming off of the 1960 World Series loss for the Yankees. It also, that loss also in some ways got Casey Stengel booted from the Yankees, who again was a Hall of Fame manager. He was getting up in his years at the time. I think he was 70. And he made the famous quote after the Yankees let him go after the 1960 World Series loss to the Pirates, that he'll never make the mistake of being 70 again. That's sort of baseball lore, Casey Stengel saying that. The other interesting thing about, really two items that were interesting about the 60 World Series, the games that the Yankees won, they basically destroyed the Pirates. I mean, they were blowout wins, all three of them that the Yankees won. They weren't even close. So it was sort of strange to see the winning team that was just getting obliterated on the three games that they lost in the seven-game series. And sort of to that note, the MVP of that World Series was Bobby Richardson, who was not a Pittsburgh Pirate. He was playing for the Pinstripes. So this is the first time you had, and the only time you had, a World Series MVP that was a player for the losing team, because he had a monster series along with Mantle. But a really cool series, and if you haven't seen or watched any of the footage or the games, check them out. You'll see baseball the way it was meant to be played back in 1960. Now, the 71 World Series, 1971, also won seven games. This was against the Baltimore Orioles at the time. And this, you know, the 1971 World Series was Roberto Clemente's showcase. That's where he just put his stamp to the nation on what an outstanding, unbelievable, talented baseball player he was. Just dominated the entire series, was the MVP, rightfully so. And that Orioles team was stacked. They had Frank Robinson and Brooks Robinson playing on their teams. They had some great pitching. What I like about that series, I love the nostalgia of that one because I loved the Pirates uniform from that era, that sort of mustard yellow, sort of nylon fabric, like the tight-fitting nylon pullover jerseys, not the button-down jerseys. Love that uniform, and I think the Pirates never should have left that uniform, but that was pretty cool to see too. And then the 79 World Series, seven games, Orioles again. This was the second World Series against the Orioles. This was Willie Stargell's World Series. You know, he was the captain of the team, the Stargell stars that he'd give stars out that they'd wear on their pillbox hats when they did something good. He had three home runs in that series. I think he was the only home runs of the entire Pirates team during that series. So the Pirates had three home runs that series, and Stargell hit all three of them. And of course, the MVP, Sister Sledge, We Are Family, you know the story there. That 79 Pirates team, when they won the World Series, that sort of created the moniker for Pittsburgh of the City of Champions, because you had in 79, not just the Pirates winning the World Series, but that the Steelers winning their fourth Super Bowl. So that's when Pittsburgh became known as the City of Champions. And that was, again, a very exciting series. Won seven games. Game seven, Grant Jackson, I think, got the win for the Pirates. And the Cobra, Dave Parker, he played prominent in the 79 World Series as well. Now, by the way, if again, I mentioned in the 60 World Series, but this is true for 71, 79, any of the World Series in the 70s, actually, you want to watch baseball and the fundamentals and how it was meant to be played. Very different than what you see today with either a strikeout or a home run every single at bat. But if you want to take a look at strategy and just exciting, tight games, tight series, go on YouTube, or you can even buy some of these World Series on DVD or stream them if you want. Watch those games game by game and inning by inning, series by series. They're just awesome to watch. Very entertaining. In fact, you know, if you really want to invest a couple of hours of good time and sports viewing, watch those World Series from the 1970s or those three Pirates World Series, and watch those instead of NFL preseason football. You'll enjoy it much better. And with everything going for it, why is baseball in the doldrums as well, like a lot of professional sports today? Well, you know, I'm not a fan of the current baseball commissioner, and I don't like seven-inning doubleheader games and juice baseballs and all that stuff that you see today. But that's only part of it. I mean, baseball's gone through its changes through the years. A designated hitter is the biggest example. It did just fine with those adjustments and evolution and modifications. Now, the reason I think that the baseball has just sort of lost its stature and its excitement and its interest is it's a fundamental underlying way that the game is structured economically. I think this goes back to economics and business and policy good design, bad design, and what the consequences are of each. So you look at baseball economics, there's not a salary cap. There's something called a luxury tax where teams that are the big spenders like the Yankees and the Dodgers and those types of teams, they will pay effectively a transfer payment or a subsidy to the teams that aren't spending as much, like the Pirates. And that creates some skewed dynamics. So it's not a free market for players, of course. It's a controlled market. It's got an antitrust exemption, which I've always questioned with baseball, why it enjoys that antitrust exemption. And you've also got a designed economic framework at play where you're effectively motivated to be one of two types of teams if you're ownership. One type of team would be the ability to raise massive amounts of revenue and spend big. So again, this is the Los Angeles Dodgers model, the New York Yankees model. You know the teams quite well by now that fit that mold. And you just outspend to get whatever player whenever you want them. And you just need to remain competitive, winning, and relevant. And to the extent that you do that, it further bolsters your brand. The revenues keep coming in, whether it's TV revenue or merchandising revenue or other type of stadium-related revenue. And that model is a very lucrative one to the point where you're literally subsidizing the other teams. The second approach you take if you're an owner is the exact opposite, which if you're from a typically small market team like Pittsburgh, then what you do is you make sure that you don't overspend. You go out of your way not to make commitments or bold strikes when it comes to player signings or extensions on contracts or player development to keep them with the team if they're showing great promise. And you keep your expenses low. You pocket your luxury subsidy that you receive from the bigger teams. You put an inferior product on the team and you're guaranteed to make money. And that's a very lucrative model as well. Where you don't want to be caught in the current sort of economic framework of baseball, at least from my perspective, is in the middle, where you don't have the revenue strength of the big boys. You might be from a mid to a small market city with a mid to small market team, and you start spending and investing significantly in players and contracts and duration and term for contract, because then you're going to get caught. If you're not winning every single year, if you're not remaining relevant every single year, you're going to run deficits. You're going to run losses. And that's a losing proposition in baseball. You're almost not being smart if you take that approach in baseball, if you're an owner or front office management. So this is by design that you've got the haves and the have-nots within the actual economic framework and wiring of baseball, Major League Baseball. And that's a shame. That's ruined the product. But this gets back to connecting the dots. We started by talking about preseason football and what I don't like about it and why I think it's not relevant. And that sort of ran into, but what else are you going to watch? Because baseball right now is in full swing, but the Pirates stink. And then we get into this discussion of the legacy, the history of the great Pirates franchise, everything it had going for it, and how baseball used to be just must see, must watch activity. And now it's not. Now it's all just little bits and bytes of this swing or that swing and that home run. What changed? And you get into now economics and policy, and how you design things economically has a big impact on the customer, in this case, the fan, and the product, which is baseball. But then let's connect that last dot back to a lot of themes that we discussed in prior episodes of these podcasts, which is how economic policy, you can wire things a certain way, or consequences, whether they're intended or unintended, can be pretty stark. So if you take what's happened with baseball, which hurt both the product of baseball and the customer, the fan, think about what we're doing with something like, say, energy policy in this country. We're not allowing the free market to dictate who the winners and who the losers are going to be. We're not allowing efficiencies and cost and reliability and resiliency and all those things that drive what your energy mix ends up looking like and what the portfolio weightings are of things like natural gas and fossil fuels versus solar or wind or nuclear. And instead, you're coming in and you're putting your thumb on the scale to weigh the scale certain ways and to create subsidy and create basically cost for the unfavored pieces of the portfolio, create subsidy for the favored, and you're skewing what should be a very competitive market, a competitive dynamic of innovation and performance, and you're replacing it with one of wired and protected market subsidy penalization of unfavored sources or options. What happens? Well, just like the product of baseball suffering, what is happening now is the product of electricity and energy is suffering. And that's not a good thing, because electricity and energy, it's more than just baseball and viewing pleasure and distraction for the customer of a fan. Electricity and power drives quality of life, as we know. Lights don't go on. We see that in California now on a regular basis. We're going to see that, I think, in more instances beyond California and in the instance of Texas this past winter. I believe, unfortunately, we will see that in other locations as well, because these types of outcomes are inevitable when you start allowing policy to dictate winners and losers instead of performance and reliability and competitiveness. And you're going to see resiliency suffer, and you're going to see costs go up. So you're going to take the product of energy and electricity, vital to everything that's going on in this economy and our society, and you're basically going to create a substandard product of it, just like we saw with baseball, because of the same types of root causes. And those things, quality of life, the lights not working, competitiveness, reliability, suffering, costs going up, those things drive quality of life, because the customers of those things, of energy and power, is everybody and everyone and everything. So we're all going to suffer the consequences. And that's a shame, because whether it's the baseball analogy or whether it's just some recent examples that we've seen in the energy space that I've mentioned, California, Texas, there will be others. We know how this story is going to end, and it didn't have to be that way. So as we wrap up episode number 15 of the Far Middle Podcast, but the first episode outside of our prior subject matter of the book, The Leech, I want to leave you with just a note that sees things the same way that I just sort of surmised them when it comes to energy policy and the implications of that. The North American Electric Reliability Corporation, that's NERC for short, does a great job of assessing grid risk and grid exposure when it comes to our electricity grid. That's their mission, effectively. And they come up with their risk rankings periodically. And their most recent risk ranking was really interesting from my perspective. When you look at the different types of risk, and this takes a look at all kinds of different holistic type of risk that is facing our electricity grid, the number one highest risk that they ranked was changing resource mix. So this gets into the wired policy and the preconceived notions of how an energy portfolio should look, and the assigning of market share, the protecting of market share, the penalization of certain aspects of our energy mix, and the subsidization of others. NERC, whose mission is to assess grid risk, ranks that at the very top of their list as the highest risk that they see out there when it comes to our grid. And I happen to agree with them. The number two risk behind that was cyber. So think about how everybody these days is worried about cybersecurity, especially in areas like energy infrastructure, and as serious of an issue that is with rogue nation states and everything going on with the internet and the ability to wreak havoc with energy infrastructure. Cyber is number two behind changing resource mix. And I think it should be behind changing resource mix. I think changing resource mix is a much bigger threat. It wasn't cyber that brought Texas down this past winter. And it's not cyber that's created now years and years of what will be rolling blackouts throughout California. It's a changing resource mix because of wrongheaded environmentalists, heavy-handed politicians, and these idealists from the left who want to dictate how things are going to be in very complicated systems that we all rely upon to enjoy our quality of life. Some other risks that ranked way lower than changing resource mix, I think this one was the most interesting to me, extreme natural events, i.e., aka climate change, middle of the risk portfolio, sort of middle of the pack. There were some that were ranked lower, and there were many that were ranked higher. So, you know, changing weather or extreme weather events, yeah, it's a risk from a grid perspective for sure, but it's middle of the pack, and it's something that our grid system has had decades of experience managing and navigating through. So that wraps up episode 15 of our Far Middle podcast. Again, follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. Check into nickdeolius.com from time to time. If you get a chance and you're up for it, pre-order your copy of The Leech coming out in January of next year. And I will be back in touch talking with you on another range of what appear to be disassociated points, but we'll connect those dots for you and bring them all together throughout podcast number 16 coming up next week. Till then, take care. See you soon.